Welcome to a new episode of Forward Thinkers. My name is Daniel Fürck, and today my guest is Roman Krisnarik, social philosopher, best-selling author, and one of the most thoughtful voices on how societies learn, adapt, and sometimes fail. In this conversation, we talk about social innovation, what history can teach us about democracy under pressure, and why technological progress alone will not carry us through the crisis of the 21st century. We discuss collective memory, the danger of comfort, and the simple but radical idea that the future depends less on the next breakthrough than on our ability to rebuild trust, solidarity, and a sense of we. If you enjoy this episode of Forward Thinkers, follow us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your podcasts, and feel free to leave us a rating.
In an ever-changing world, we need to keep track of what will be next. Forward Thinkers is your 48 Forward podcast to discover the future. We are talking to innovative and creative minds from all over the world to learn more about what they are working on and what they think will change the way we work and live within the next decade. Are you ready to join the ride? Welcome to Forward Thinkers.
Roman, it's so nice to meet you here at DLD in Munich to talk about social innovation, to talk about how our societies on this planet are adapting to everything that is happening right now and why we are struggling with all of that sometimes. Welcome.
I'm looking forward to the conversation. Let's see where the adventure of dialogue takes us.
So your talk here at the conference is about social innovation and what we can learn from history. And I thought about that a lot over the last couple of days, because if we look at history, there have been so many, like countless challenges, and somehow humanity survived all of them. And nowadays, we are always talking about things moving faster, developing faster, it's more complex and whatever. If you look at history, is it really that different? Or are we just pretending to tell everyone that those times are completely different and we've never seen something like that before?
I think every era, every period thinks that their period is unique. So we think we're in the fastest moving moment of history, the great acceleration of everything, of technology and so on. This is how people felt in the 19th century with the telephone and the telegraph and the steam engine and all these things. They thought that things were moving so fast, we were going to all have nervous breakdowns. There were psychologists saying that in the late 19th century. So in that sense, nothing's unique. And I think also what's important here is that, of course, the world is different than in the past. No, we didn't have runaway AI in the 17th century. We didn't have climate breakdown like we have it today. But I think we can still draw strong historical parallels. We can still learn. This is not to say that history is a blueprint, you know, or a perfect replica of the present. It's just say, look, if you're driving a car, you will always look in the rearview mirror, right? You would be crazy not to do that. That's all I'm saying. So in a new book I've written, History for Tomorrow, which just came out in German as well, I'm just simply saying, look, most of our politicians and policymakers, they are caught in the present tense, the tyranny of the now, the next election, the next opinion poll, or businesses are looking at the next quarterly report. There's an obsession that technology is going to solve all our problems for us. But actually, when I look through history, what I notice is that yes, technological innovation has been important, but so is social innovation. The way that human beings have organized, responded to crises, developed new practices and policies to overcome problems. And I find that incredibly inspirational. And normally when we think about learning from the past, in a way, we're following that famous aphorism, that idea that those who cannot remember the past are condemned to repeat themselves. You know, we're going to just repeat our mistakes if we don't learn from history. But that's only looking at the warnings, everything that's gone wrong. I'm interested also looking at what's gone right. What can we learn from that?
If we look at politics, 100 years ago, we've seen a lot of things in a different way, in a different context. But at the same time, we've seen a lot of challenges that are kind of repeating themselves right now. And at the same time, we tend to, if we look at, like, you know, the whole right-wing shift all over Europe and also the US, we should have learned that that is not a good idea from the past. And at the same time, we are kind of doing the same again. Why?
I think there's lots of ways to think about that. Yes, of course, we can draw parallels between today and, say, Europe in the 1930s, Italy, Germany, all these countries where we see, for example, the underlying economic instability, joblessness, economic insecurity, and on that basis, far-right parties build ideologies that demonize immigrants, which turn everybody into enemies, you know. And so, of course, we're seeing that. But I think we need to think more creatively about history. Yes, we can draw those kind of parallels, but let's also try and think about if we wanted to, for example, deal with the issue of the rise of far-right populism, what could history tell us? Well, one thing I think is interesting is that we can do democracy in different ways. A lot of people say, oh, well, okay, we could try and become like Singapore and kind of have benign dictators, good dictators, you know. But that's not the only option that we have. If you look through history, we can go to places like in Switzerland, right? In the 17th, 18th centuries, in a part of Switzerland called the Republic of the Three Leagues or the Free State of Rhaetia, which most people haven't heard of. In fact, I'd never heard of it till a few years ago, and I used to be a university politics lecturer. They had a kind of a radical democratic republic where decisions were made from the grassroots. Most decisions were made in villages and local towns. And then they would have bigger decisions at a regional level. They wouldn't have elected representatives like we have today with representative democracy. They basically sent like delegates or messengers up to the next level. And then they had a kind of Bundestag, a kind of federal assembly that met a couple of times a year. This lasted for a couple of hundred years. It was a grassroots form of democracy. Why does that matter today? Because when you talk to people, for example, who will vote for the far-right parties, a lot of them will say, well, look, the reason I don't like our current political system is because these are elites. These people don't know anything about my life. My voice is not heard. I have no sense of agency. So what you can learn from history actually is that what you can do is find other ways of giving people a sense of inclusion, participation in democracy, make it more decentralized, more grassroots, more citizens' assemblies, all these kinds of things. So, you know, this is not about finding utopian solutions to our problems. It's about saying, actually, let's just look in the rearview mirror. We've got plenty of inspiration to draw on. These are not totally different cultures or periods. You know, human beings are pretty similar today to the way they were in the 18th century. You know, they fall in love, they get angry, they're greedy, they're cooperative, they're everything, you know. So let's learn from that history.
If we look back at the last two or three decades, we are basically coming from a time that has been maybe, especially in the Western countries, we are coming from a time that has been, from my point of view, when I look at what is happening now, maybe a bit too comfortable. We didn't have major crises. We didn't really have any fears. Economic development was great. So did those decades made us a bit too lazy when it comes to social innovation and social change, which we need now to adapt to what is coming?
My short answer to that question is yes. I think that's right, actually. I think this has to do partly with the way that we forget the past. You know, we forget the struggles that people went through to fight against authoritarianism or fascism and to establish democracy. We forget the fights that like trade unions fought just to get basic things like an 8-hour working day. You know, we let those things slip away too quickly. And there's a kind of failure of memory there. But I think it is also something to do with the kind of comfort that we have. And we're going to have to learn that we're going to need to struggle, maybe on the streets, to protect these basic civil rights or economic and political rights. And I think there's a certain kind of waking up to that. You know, it's not as fast as it needs to be. But I think you're right that there's a kind of a complacency, a kind of comfort. And I think what's really important here also is to recognize that you can create something good, let's say a welfare state that provides public health care, which I think is important. It's very easy to destroy it. It's hard to build it back again. You know, things can fall apart fast. It's what we're seeing with Trump in the United States, the erosion of basic civil and political rights, the rise of authoritarianism. Now, to get all of that back, it's going to be hard. It's going to take social struggle and political organization and all those things. But I think fundamentally, the problem of a kind of complacency and comfortableness, it's reflected in a kind of historical forgetting.
I think one of the symptoms I at least see, and I wonder what you say to that, I had a conversation with a another journalist a couple of weeks ago, and we talked about 9/11. And 9/11 was, from my point of view, some kind of a key moment when it comes to journalism and how we dealt with major crises. Because back then, we talked weeks and weeks and even months about what happened during 9/11. We had some kind of emotional connection to what happened. We felt something. And nowadays, if we look at major crises, then they are basically vanished from our minds within a week. And this kind of short-term thinking, because we are so overloaded with information, with news, we are learning about everything that happens on this planet, and at the same time, we are not able to process it properly, because while we try to do that, the next thing is already around the corner. Is that something that actually makes social innovation and social change more or less impossible?
It's a good question. Maybe you can answer it better than me, since you are in the media world more than me. I'm just a writer who sits in a small room in a garden in Oxford in the UK trying to think about some of these things. I mean, I think underlying that question is something very important about the nature of crises. So if you look through history, sometimes crises have kick-started us to create fundamental, rapid, transformative change. So a war will do this. So in Britain, the rationing of food, or in Germany too, rationing of food in the Second World War was introduced. Now, I personally believe we should be rationing carbon and red meat and things like that today. I know it's not very popular, but in the Second World War, that kind of thing was possible because of crisis, extreme crisis, or COVID, right? Another example. When you have an epidemic, a famine, or something like that, sometimes governments react quickly. Now, today, we do have crises, melting ice sheets, wildfires, financial instability, AI threats, all these things. We tend not to respond at the speed and scale required. Why not? I think one of the answers is in your question, which is that it's lost in the information space, you know? And so we can't almost see the crisis because, you know, one moment it's Ukraine and next moment it's something happening in Venezuela, then there's something happening in Greenland and so on. But I think there's something more fundamental than that, actually. I don't actually think that is a major barrier. I think we can respond to crises, but two other things are fundamental. What you need is new ideas and models to replace the old system. So if you've got a financial crash in 2008, you need something else to take its place. That didn't happen in 2008 because we didn't have the available models, new models like well-being economy, post-growth economics, degrowth, or donut economics, things like that. And the other thing you need is you need movements. You need disruptive movements to amplify the crisis. So the crisis, which is maybe in the media and lost in all the information, someone needs to pick it up. Groups of people, movements, and put it onto the political agenda and make sure it stays there in the same way that 9/11 stayed on the agenda. And once you've got these three things, crisis, ideas, and movements, I call it the disruption nexus in my new book, then you can often get the changes that we need.
We've seen movements like that. Black Lives Matter was one. Fridays for Future was another one. But maybe it's just a coincidence, but all of them happened before the pandemic. And somehow I sometimes have the feeling that we forgot how to connect with each other on a larger scale during the pandemic. And we still are in the process to relearn that, to organize us, to kind of establish bigger movements that are not only like one protest going on, but something that is like more, at least midterm, and not just like a one-time action. Do you think we can relearn what we knew before, like before the pandemic, to regain some kind of social awareness, a social community awareness?
I think it's certainly true that the pandemic was something that stopped in movements which were very vibrant in the couple of years before that. As you said, Fridays for Future, Black Lives Matter. We were sort of distracted into something else. But at the same time, I think actually the pandemic created an incredibly strong sense of community in many places. I mean, just to give you a very simple example, on my street where I live in Oxford in the UK, we set up a WhatsApp group to help elderly people and others who couldn't go out of their homes and deliver them food and help them in various other ways too. That was set up during the pandemic in a street where most of us didn't really know each other very well. That WhatsApp group still exists. Okay. At the moment now, it's used for basic things like if your kid has grown out of using their bike, we'll give away the bike to someone else, or we'll have a little organized little street markets. That group is now ready for a crisis, the next crisis that comes. And this is all around the world. Right? So I think there's a kind of latent potential of community. And I think movements like Fridays for Future are not dead. They will come back because the crises have not gone away. Right? Social movements always come and go in waves. You know, when there's energy and then the energy goes, or people get involved and they think, my God, we can't change anything. So they give up and then a new generation comes. And because, for example, just in the example of Fridays for Future, because of the ecological crisis is not going away, it is a slow form of violence, a slow violence which gets worse year on year, decade on decade, like we've seen with floods in Valencia last year, wildfires across Europe in the summer. I was cycling near them in Croatia with my kids. That stuff's just going to get worse. We know that. And because governments are not responding at the speed and scale required, the movements will come back. And I think this capacity to organize is a very, very human thing. It's a very human, I'm not saying it's easy to do, but in a sense, we will relearn. We will relearn.
As you're already talking about climate change, I think we underestimate the impact on societies still. And also from a political point of view, we are not truthful enough in talking about what will change in the next maybe 50 years. And maybe even a little bit of a philosophical question, but the way we are organizing this world right now, with this crazy amount of different countries, borders, institutions, organizations, is this something that can actually work in 50 years, or do we have to do something that is radically different? Because, you know, in the end, we will see a world where people get born in some region that is heavily impacted by climate change, in like areas that are not suitable to live there anymore. And it's basically just like a birth lottery. Is this something that can last? Because it's highly unfair. Will there be a time where humanity is rethinking how to organize to not let luck decide?
That's a very interesting question. I mean, if you think, for example, about the various kinds of impacts that ecological emergency will have, I mean, there are many kinds, but one thing we know is that there will most certainly be huge problems of global food security over the next 1, 2, 3 decades, as areas which have been traditional big agricultural producers will not be able to produce what they did. This will cause unbelievable disruption across the globe. And one of the forms of disruption will be the movement of people, because people will move from those areas. They might move within countries, but they will also move between countries. UN estimates say by 2050, there could be 1 billion people, like roughly 1 in 10 people on the move in some form. I don't think our current political and economic institutions can handle that. Something's going to need to change. And I think we're going to go through a period of sort of semi-permanent turbulence. We feel like everything's kind of crazy now. That's going to stay. That's not going away. This is the world that we will live in. And so in a sense, to me, I could answer that question by saying, okay, we need to change democracy in a certain way and have more decentralized politics, and we need to have citizen assemblies. I could answer it with regard to economics and say, well, we need to have post-growth economies. I could answer it with respect to immigration and say we need to think about what immigration laws look like and so on. But ultimately, getting at the heart of the problem, I think if we're going to survive through a period of turbulence, economic, political, social, technological, there's one thing we need, which is to turn me into we. We need to create the bonds of social trust, which enable us to survive through crises. In this new book I've written, History for Tomorrow, I came across, when I was doing the research, a 14th century Islamic historian called Ibn Khaldun. Not many people have heard of him, but he wrote a very famous book in the 14th century called the Muqaddima. And it was one of the first great books of sociology of history. What causes the rise and fall of civilizations? And there's a word that occurs in his book over 500 times, an Arabic word, which is asabiya, asabiya. What asabiya means is collective solidarity or group feeling. And Ibn Khaldun believed that those societies which thrived and rose up were ones which had strong asabiya, strong social trust. The ones which declined had weak asabiya, weak social trust, for example, if they become very unequal in terms of wealth. I think there's a message here for our times about why the ultimate thing that we need, if I was going to say one thing we need, is this asabiya. How do we connect with each other, with our neighbors, have conversations so that when, you know, the shit hits the fan, you know, we survive. And you see this, you mentioned a bit earlier, you know, 9/11. What happened after 9/11? Immediately, we saw communities responding on the streets of Manhattan, where Jews and Muslims cooperating together to run a soup kitchen. You know, this is what often human beings are quite good at after a crisis happens. In a way, we need to start doing it now before the crises really happen and start building those bonds of asabiya.
My listeners are probably already bored by that example, but I told you about Finland earlier. And I've been traveling there for the last 11 years, way more than 100 times. And I always had the feeling that there is something different. And I spent a lot of time trying to figure out what that difference actually is. And then I realized it's exactly that we understanding. If you talk to a Finnish guy about politics, they are always talking about we are doing stuff, we are changing, we are whatever. If you talk to a German, it's always they in Berlin, they in the parliament, they. It's not we. Maybe that's the key in the end. We need to relearn that we are a society that is dependent on every single human being that is living within that society, and only we all together can make a positive change.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting. It's interesting to bring up Finland because, of course, Finland is a country where historically it was trapped between, you had Swedish colonialism on one side and you had Russian imperialism on the other, and there's Finland in the middle. And that's why Finland had an incredible nationalist movement emerge in the 19th century. And so that's the sort of the roots of the we. But the roots of the we in Finland, as I understand it, and I'm no great expert on Finnish history, was also through social organization. So, for example, in the 19th century in Finland, you had these women's education movements emerge. A lot of women were quite highly educated, and they were the ones who went on the streets and fought for women's right to vote and to engage in politics. So that's why in 1906, they had their famous law, which was giving the vote to women. So in 1907, they had elections of, I think, over 20 women into parliament. And those women then went on to organize and fight for social welfare state. And that's part of the story, not the only part of the story, but part of the story why Finland went from being one of the poorest countries in Europe in 1900 to one of the richest countries only a century later. That's amazing. But there's something very fundamental, as you say, about the we-ness there. So the question then is, how do we create we? You know, how do we shift from the hyper-individualism of the 20th century inherited from neoliberal economics and the self-help industry from, Freud to Oprah, and shift to something, rediscover in a way, collective values, the common good? I think there's no easy solution to this, but conversations is important. If you could do one thing to create the we, I would say it's go and have a conversation with a stranger once a week. On the bus, on the train, in the supermarket queue. Try and get beyond superficial talk. Talk to someone whose views are different from your own. And when I look at history in my new book, it's the history of conversation, which is so fundamental, actually. It's a forgotten kind of history. You know, one of the greatest social innovations in human history in the last 500 years is something called the coffee house, you know, which came from Turkey to Europe in the 17th century. In London by 1800, there were more than 2,000 of them. And if you walked into a coffee house in 1700, there were something very interesting you would notice is that those coffee houses had communal tables. You would sit and you would talk to strangers. On the table were the newspapers and pamphlets, periodicals of the day, and you'd sit down and read them and talk to the person opposite you about republicanism or anti-slavery. You know, let's do that today. You know, We've had a revival of the coffee house, in the last 30 years. Every coffee shop should have a communal table. I mean, you might kind of think I'm joking, but actually this is seriously how you start creating social bonds. We need to reinvent the kinds of institutions that we have, because you cannot survive a turbulent time without community.
That's, by the way, the reason why we have a bar at the office, which developed into kind of a community space where even people from other offices are stopping.
That's a great example of it, actually. You need to, these places like a bar or a coffee shop is a social technology. In the same way, like a city is a social technology as well. Cities are very good at mixing people together. And within them, they have sort of sub-technologies like coffee shops and bars, football teams, this kind of thing, which, again, is a great way of getting people to meet with strangers.
One final look at history. We've seen, in the last centuries, we've seen the downfall of big empires and systems. And I always have the feeling that always happened when they got too comfortable, when they got too big, when they just forgot about the fact that they could actually fail. What can we learn from those downfalls? And is this world we are living in doomed to fail as well in the system we have today?
I think there's two things we can learn from the history of the rise and fall of civilizations. The first one is that no civilization lasts forever. They all rise, they flower, and they die. There's a study by a guy at Cambridge University called Luke Kemp, who tried to measure the length of ancient civilizations. How long do the Egyptians survive for, or the Assyrians, or whoever, the Romans? On average, he said a civilization survives for about 336 years. Some longer, some shorter. So let's not think that our global kind of capitalist civilization is going to last forever. It won't. I think the second thing to learn is that there are many, many causes of why civilizations do not survive. Sometimes they overuse their economic resources. Sometimes they're invaded by outsiders. But one of the major things is inequality. Very unequal societies don't survive crises very effectively because of what we've been talking about, in a way, which is the social bond. Because what happens is the elites at the top think that they can protect themselves, so they don't try and solve the crisis. And it gets worse and worse and worse. And this is what we're seeing like with the Silicon Valley tech oligarchs and so on. They don't really care if the world burns because they think they're going to be okay in their bunkers, right? This is the perfect recipe for civilizational collapse. We are watching it in real time as these huge AI models get released with consequences which we cannot control or we do not understand. We've now got these models that are refusing to turn themselves off when we ask them to, that they will blackmail in order to keep themselves in operation. It's extraordinary. Who knows where it will go? Right? But actually, underneath this is something about inequalities. Like, who owns the technology? Can we make it more publicly owned? Can we have steward ownership, like the way a company like Patagonia is owned? There are different ways of doing things, and this is what history teaches us.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening. Did you enjoy the episode? Follow us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you prefer listening to your favorite podcast shows. Forward Thinkers is a 48 Forward podcast produced in the 48 Forward Studios in Munich.